This is the panel, The World That Players Wouldn't Let Die. Rand actually had called it The World That Wouldn't Die, but we felt that sounded a little negative and a little too cynical. That's right. So we're going to talk today about a very unique MMO and how it applies, hopefully, to the work you're doing in virtual worlds and massive multiplayer game. Now, Myst Online has the distinction of being a multiplayer game that has failed commercially, not once, but twice. And, yeah. And but the interesting thing and the important thing was is that the community that grew out of Myst Online, the beta, which started in 2003, is still alive and very, very vibrant community. So this community has gone through several different instances of this game, and they continue to try and recreate their home, not only in the Myst game itself that we'll discuss, but also off in other virtual spaces. So what we found was is that the community was a tremendous pointer to where virtual world spaces and massive multiplayer games collide. Because clearly in this environment, the people created a sense of identity that went beyond the game. And yet the game was what they identified with. So we've got a lot. To get you into this, we need to go through a bunch of background. So very, very quickly, I'm going to introduce our panelists. Over here to my right is Rand Miller. He was the visionary and the creator of the Myst series and Myst Online. Ron Miners is community director at the Hollywood Interactive Group, but when the beta came out in 2003, Ron was the community lead at Ubisoft. My name is Blake Lewin. I'm vice president of media and entertainment platforms at Turner Broadcasting, and I was executive producer on the second round of Myst Online. Celia Pierce is assistant professor of gameplay at Georgia Tech, and Celia has the distinction of being the only Uru anthropologist in the room, so please make sure you talk to her after the presentation. And then Ellery Hamilton is a Myst fan and one of the many that made this game so successful. While not commercially, it was definitely a big success in terms of massive multiplayer environments and storytelling. All right, so to move forward, and to give you the background on the community, you really have to go back to the very beginning. Myst came out in 1993, huge success, best-selling CD-ROM of the 20th century, only surpassed by The Sims in, I think it was 2002. 2001, I stand corrected. Yet the games, there were, you know, several different versions of it. There were books, there were CDs. So the community had a chance to grow there, but it was a single-player point-and-click adventure game. In 1997, after the release of Riven, Rand decided to go full 3D, and I'm going to let him discuss the vision behind it. But what was very, very different about his vision and what drew the attention of Turner was we were looking for new opportunities for network programming. And we saw that broadband was going to bring in a whole different type of programming other than video. So one of the interesting things that we were drawn to in the Uru game was the idea of building this virtual space in which story and interactive content was put into it on a weekly, daily, monthly basis, very similar to how we program television networks. So Rand built it and built up his company for 6 years. Ubisoft released it. And right as the box product went out and beta was launched, Ubisoft got cold feet. A lot of forces in the marketplace were kind of putting downward pressure on how difficult it was to launch a massive multiplayer game. And the beta was closed. So at that time, there were about 10, 40,000 people in the beta. And they had fallen in love with not just the environment, but who they were in that environment. And so they went off and through several different hack attempts and then communicating with Cyan, created Until Uru. And one reporter definitely noted that Uru has lasted longer when the fans are running it than when a publisher has run it. So for 2 years, almost 2.5 years, the fans ran their own servers and basically had this empty city underground that was the shell of a game. But they made a lot with what they had, and that's what Celia and Ellery are going to discuss. In 2006, GameTap picked it up and tried to bring it back. But in that time, Rand's vision of the content that would pull out, all that content had been released as expansion packs or Myst 5. So as it came back to be released, it really was nothing more than the game that it had originally been, but it had none of the content and the content production pipeline that it needed to sustain. So a year later, GameTap closed it down. It was still successful in terms of a game within GameTap, but it just wasn't driving the kind of revenue that was necessary to fund the programming behind it. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Rand, and he's going to discuss the overall vision behind his work here.
That's me, the visionary. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. What kind of crazy people come to a panel discussion of a failed game, huh? Huh? What's wrong with you people? Well, I'll tell you who. The people who are smart, because you can learn a lot more from something that fails than something that succeeds. Okay, so you people are all brilliant. Okay, can I just start by saying that? Thank you for showing up, you brilliant people. Okay. Okay, there's a lot I could cover about Myst. Everybody wants to know why Myst was successful, blah, 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 blah. Suffice it to say that at some point we took stock of what Myst was and came up with a couple conclusions of what we thought was interesting. I don't have time to go into everything, but we're going to call out a few interesting points of Myst. Okay, the first one is exploration. Okay, this is easy, no-brainer, what's around the next corner. People are curious. Are you guys curious? You're always curious. That's why you're in here, right? You're curious. People want to know what's around the next corner. And if it's interesting, they especially want to know. If it's boring, it's not so much. But generally, they want to know what's around the next corner. Okay? The other thing is community. People like to share their journey of discovering what's around the next corner. All right? So you might think that's ridiculous because Myst was a single-player game. But in fact, what we found was that people talked all the time when they played Myst. They either sat in pairs in front of the screen, or after they played, they chatted on the phone, or they talked to each other at work the next day. What'd you find around the next corner? Or how many corners did you get around? So they want to share it. Those two things, it doesn't take a rocket science to figure that out, the community and exploration. So it comes time to design Myst Online. Now, our goal on Myst Online was not to do the same thing over and over again. We wanted the essence of what Myst was. We weren't just going to build the same thing everybody else was building. Let's try and take some of those things that were successful in Myst and put it into the online experience. So, naturally, we're going to pull those two things in. Community, duh, it's online. Okay, that's a no-brainer. You're going to do online. Now, we like to think that we did some interesting things with community, like allow people to play with a couple of their friends in a very intimate environment instead of thousands of their closest friends. So we built in instancing systems that made it feel like a very private game. And in fact, you could play most of the game by yourself if you wanted to. Most people didn't, but you could do that if you wanted. That was important. The point was, online gives you community. The other part about community, though, is we wanted to tweak this community idea a bit so that it fit the Myst idea. Myst was never a role-playing game. In Myst, you played yourself. And in Uru, we wanted to do the same thing. We wanted you to play you. Now, that's interesting to take this great story and mythology and try and bring it up, bring it to a place where people can feel like it's them, but that's what we did. That's why the orange cone is on there. Who expects an orange cone in a Myst game? But we put an Airstream trailer in an orange cone because we wanted people to realize that the Myst story was now intersecting current day life. And when you went down to explore what was going on, it was as if it was really happening. We wanted to blur the lines just a little bit between reality and virtual reality. We wanted you to be you, or the you were before your midlife crisis. Okay. exploration. Now, this is the other aspect, and this is big to me. This is big. If you this is something that somebody is going to do, and I hope they learn from what we did, because I think this is, besides the community, there's an essence here that's a core of what everybody who's doing games should look at. We talked about this. What's around the next corner? Well, if you're making an online game, we weren't looking at this connection, this massively multiplayer part as this end-all, be-all. We thought that the pipeline that we had to everybody's home who was playing Uru was a content delivery pipeline. Not only could we connect people who wanted to play together, but we could use that pipeline to pump content to them. Imagine, instead of having them go to the same place all the time, they could go to different places. The idea is, if people like to find out what's around the corner, then they want to find out around the next corner and the next corner, and what if those corners never end? And I think I can get down here to like 1-point font, because that was my goal with that. Yay!
Okay.
Let's see here. I do have notes. The more corners we delivered, the more exciting this got to us, because it felt like it wasn't... this was not just a game like the traditional sense. This was competing, or had the potential, of course, in the visionary's mind, of competing with television, because people came home and watched television wondering what was new that night. What would they see new that night? Well, what if it wasn't what you would watch that night, but where would you go new that night? If we could supply content all the time, people would come back. If we built it, they would come, supposedly. Okay. The idea was to build a pipeline for never-ending stories, meticulous worlds that would just keep going and going and going, new adventures every night. But if you want to keep people walking, you want to keep people exploring, you want people walking all the time, frankly, it's a lot cheaper to build a treadmill than a national park. And what we were building was a national park. This was not a small undertaking. We weren't setting people in a little hamster wheel and saying, run, 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 run. We were saying, no, we'll build a park for you. Go explore. So crazy enough, we actually managed to pull that off and get to the point where we're ready to go beta. We were ready to launch a thing. I'm going to show you just a quick little movie so that those of you who haven't seen any parts of it will get a taste of what it was about. Actually just captured footage from the game. Pardon?
Started when?
Oh, 2001.
Yeah, this video is from 2003. The engine was started in like 98,
yeah.
Right?
These are just some of the examples of the places and the worlds. Very little repeating stuff. This is a neighborhood that people met in. Our idea of linking books and myths lent itself well to making unlimited ages or worlds. This is another example. Dunny civilization, which was an ancient underground civilization. This was the city that everybody finally got to explore. Yay. So we did it. We pulled it off. We put all that stuff together. We had dozens of ages. You know, at the end of it, we had, I don't know how many ages. actually haven't counted them a lot, because we did start, you know, building content ahead of time, even to release it. All that had to be planned like you would with
Lost.
A studio ahead of time. All that was done. The story we built backwards and forwards with a thread that wove all the way through it, where people could explore the story and become part of it in an interesting way. We had actors who played roles in this game that you might run across, who basically became virtual celebrities, even in the testing and over the years. And I know everybody will laugh at that, but it's kind of an interesting phenomenon, have a virtual celebrity. And we had about 40,000 people in the original beta, and we were ready to go, but we kind of had some problems, and it got canceled. And of course, you're here because kind of got canceled. So the point is, what can we learn with all of this, where we went, what we did wrong, what we did right? Is there anything, with all the expense and time and effort that we put into this, that people who are making games can draw on this? And you know what? Frankly, if anybody can look at the arrows in our back and learn something from them and move forward, I'll be very happy with what we did.
Hey.
Pass the mic.
And that clicks. Okay. All right. Hi, all. I'm Ron Miners. I was, at the time, lead community manager with Ubisoft. I'm here to talk about community. Starting out, what we had, as Rand mentioned, Myst had always been a very interactive and community, functionally a community game, with people who would talk about the experience with their coworkers, or play with family members, or use it as a way to connect with family members, people playing with their children, and so forth. And that had given rise to a lot of activity online, exploring this shared passion. There were fan sites, there were real-time gatherings like Mysterium, where people actually gathered together, as well as the beginning of some of the identity blurring that happened with Uru, where the players, as Rand said, were actually explorers, and there was a lot of implied impetus to create yourself as a character. There was this wonderful kind of invitation to play yourself in this exciting, sort of adventurous and challenging world, and thus to create an alter ego that maybe, as somebody said, was a few years younger and a few pounds lighter, but was basically you. And
much wiser.
Yes, and and unlike other games where it was clear that your alter ego was sort of, demonstrably not you, most of us are not orcs, there was an invitation here to really sort of connect the two identities and two experiences, which I think is really a delightful idea. Part of what had been an early exploration of that was one of the very early alternate reality games called The Pre-After, which involved a set of puzzles and locations to find and so forth, and again sort of involve people directly in the experience of this stuff as an adventure. Let's see, yay. Our role as community managers was sort of twofold. One was that in addition to the existing core community that had been there since the beginning and had watched the growth of Uru and the mists of Uru, or the myths and rumors of Uru, and finally we're here in this long promised wonderland. There was also a number of people who were perhaps drawn in by the Ubisoft advertising and had never really experienced this before, and were new to virtual worlds, new to this whole mythos. And so, part of our job was to create an experience primarily outside the game that blended these two different kind of groups of people. In general, the role of the community team, I think, in an MMO is to, or a virtual world, is to augment the experience inside the world by creating activities or social connections or ways that people can augment their experience or supplement their experience or support it by what they're finding in the outside world. At one point, too, we sort of started exploring taking a role two, in fostering in-world community activities as well. And it was always sort of a blurry line in working with Cyan and the design team as to kind of what they had in mind and what we could do to sort of supplement that without getting in their way. One example that has been used is of a roller coaster, and that to a certain extent a sort of traditional game is like a roller coaster, with the designer crafting an experience that sort of goes through various loops and up and down and around and that curve. And an MMO or a virtual game that has a community, a live community element, is sort of what happens after the roller coaster. And there's a certain kind of shared experience that forms as a baseline, but you also want to create ways that people can interact sort of based around that. One of the ones that the community actually came up with early on took advantage of, I should have used one of your slides, took advantage of one of the bugs in the game, which is that if you sat down at a certain place on one of the stair railings, the physics engine had trouble placing you and would actually move you down a notch, which resulted in a repeat of the same thing. So if you sat down at the top of one of the stair railings, you would soon scoot down to the bottom. Rand also mentioned the cones that were available in the world. You seeing where this is going? So people would nudge cones into perfect little bowling patterns and then run to the top of the staircase and scoot down. And it's that sort of thing. And that was all sort of community driven. But that was the sort of thing that we in the community team were sort of wanting to foster and wanting to help with as much as possible to, again, sort of create supplementary experiences for the community around the game. Let's see. So one of the things that we did was to try to create a sort of umbrella social identity for the players that we at least promoted from our position as the community team, and one that was inclusive of all the sort of disparate elements, and one that especially celebrated what we saw as kind of key and core aspects of the community we were working with. And what we did was we tried to focus on the sort of heroic aspects of it. Our community was explorers. Our community was adventurers. They were not especially interested in conflict. They didn't really want to compete with each other. They were there to be challenged and to test themselves and overcome these challenges. And secondarily, the community itself had a huge demographic. And I know Celia is going to talk a little bit about that, but it was right across the board. I've met Uru fans who were 7, and I've met Uru fans or players who were in their 70s and everything in between. So one of the things that we wanted to promote was the inclusivity of the group and the family friendliness of it. What we did as a community team was to create the Mist Worlds site, and the sort of the concept was to that it would act as a sort of nexus and umbrella, and would link and push people out into other sort of constituent fan-based community at Uru Obsession or. Perhaps the Denny Linguistic Fellowship or my favorite, the Denny Jazz Club. I told Tweek I had to put that in because I still think it's one of the best names for a site ever. But anyway, that the Mist World site would sort of be an umbrella and kind of, serve as a clearinghouse and nexus for people. And in general, our goal was to, as much as possible, help create a positive social experience, which would create, a more satisfying player experience, which would create a positive brand association, which would create a desire to do viral marketing, either sort of implicitly or explicitly. We had a couple of efforts that tried to do that. So it becomes a win-win all the way around. If people are having fun, meeting friends, and having a good experience, then the developer, the publisher, and certainly the community all come ahead. Let's see. And specifically, what we tried to do, we did a number of promotions that sort of tried to encourage the players and community to create new content. Most of these are from I saw the one at the bottom with Rand as Neo and lost my focus there. Yeah. And this was from a photo play contest that we did with people submitting their own sort of, you know, Photoshop doctored images that were had to do with Uru and so forth. And then there was a public, you know, judgment of which ones were the tops and prizes and stuff like that. In addition, we also actually I helped start and we encouraged the Guild of Greeters, which was an important social connection group. These were people who welcomed newcomers into the game and formed social connections with them in doing so, became mentors if possible, and also had a great time kind of helping others out and meeting new people. It was, turned out to be a very positive experience all around. There were other guilds that we were talking to people about in those early days that are now, I think, coming to fruition in the forums that are coming out. Let's see. And yeah, so the bottom line is sort of that the community really formed itself as a community, and I think there are a number of elements that have kept it together. Specifically, there was a passionate shared interest that people had. Cyan was very positively regarded and very involved with the community and encouraged people. There was a shared experience. Even the negative aspect, I mean, one of the things that bonded me with the community probably more than anything else was the closure of the beta before it even launched. And anybody who went through that, I mean, you know, we shed the same tears, and, you know, that's a bond that I'm going to carry with me. It was a very inclusive culture, and at last, I think there were lots of ways that people could contribute to the experience of others, and all of these have contributed to a very sort of long-lasting community experience. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ron. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my research about what happened to the Uru community after the beta closed. And this is actually my PhD thesis project, and is also going to be a book that's coming out next year from MIT Press called Communities of Play. So as Ron was saying, after the six-month beta period, the game closed, and this was a very traumatic experience for the players, and many players actually sent me screenshots of the final moments of Uru, including this image of people hugging, which was an emergent behavior that was done by looking at your PDA on your wrist. And if you put your arms up like this and you were close enough to other people, you could make yourself look like you were hugging them. So this was a group hug that happened in the last hour of the game. And this is the final screen that basically announced that the server was being turned off. And many people that I talked to after the fact described a post-traumatic stress kind of experience at this having happened. What's interesting about these players is that they really, many of them had not played an online game before. In interviewing them, many of them told me that they were loners. And so I described them as a community of loners, although as Rand mentioned, they had often played the game. There are many people that actually played the game while talking on the phone, which was reported by several players. And then what they proceeded to do was they proceeded to scout in other virtual worlds for areas that they could settle. The picture on the upper left is the Uru Hood Fountain, which is a very important social artifact because it was the sort of center of the social life of Uruvians. And when they would move into other worlds, it was one of the first things that they would reconstruct. So on the upper right is the Uru Fountain as recreated by players in Ver.com. The lower right is the Second Life instantiation, and the lower left is made by a player in Adobe Atmosphere. So this was kind of the anchor of the whole community. And what was interesting was that the players not only brought their culture from Uru, but they also brought their identities. They developed what I call transludic identities. They actually recreated the same avatars in the other virtual worlds with the same names and the same characteristics. And they would refer to themselves as Uru refugees or Uruvians. And they would talk about collective characteristics. And this is a very important finding in my research, is that because these players, many of them, most of them, had been missed related game fans for over a decade, they were sort of trained to a certain type of gameplay and a certain way of thinking about play that they all shared. But yet they had been living in this world in pretty much in isolation with the smaller social interactions, but suddenly they were all together in this world that they had all lived in for 10 years. So this kind of explains a lot about the bond. It wasn't just out of the blue that this brand new game created this bond. These people were already kind of nurturing this bond over the prior decade. This is also this one of the things that was interesting in looking at some of the documents and the discussions that happened on the forums was that there were sort of two main groups that split off. One went into Second Life, about 200 people, and their agenda was to recreate Uru. And so they actually rebuilt three of the major areas of the game in an almost exact facsimile. And these are some screenshots. The upper left is the original Uru game, and the right is the Second Life version that players made. So they knew the game so well that they could replicate pretty much the entire thing. This island that was created in Second Life was later reopened to promote Myst Online Uru Live, which is the first case I know of a really fan-created art project being used to promote a product. And these are some other examples of how this culture kind of merged with cultures of other worlds. So the picture in the center here is Yisha, who's the main character of the game. And if any of you know the Myst games, she's the younger sister of it's Cirrus and Akinar. And she is kind of the principal protagonist in the game. And in there, one of the first things players did was they made a costume, which was called a Yisha. Which was an attempt to replicate her costume in the game. They also actually made a Yisha avatar that they would bring out from time to time, complete with the red dreadlocks to go with the character. The Relto, which was the home base of the player on the upper right, was sort of cobbled together from existing elements in there when they first came. And eventually they started merging other things. So in the middle here you see a Yisha buggy, which was sort of using the there.com culture and merging the Uru culture with it. So these are just a few examples of that. One of the things that was really interesting about the demographic of the research that I did was that this game has a very, very broad appeal. One of the most interesting things, at least about the community that I studied in there.com primarily, is that it was exactly half female. And for those who study MMOGs, that's actually pretty unprecedented. Most of the MMOG communities are about 80% male. And the sort of largest distribution of age, as you can see from this chart, and this was actually players, this was from a survey that we conducted. I actually helped with the relaunching of Myst Online. We developed a survey of players that were playing in Until Uru, and this was one of the outcomes of this, that we had this really significant chunk of baby boomers, of which a high percentage were female. And this is the sort of coveted market that nobody seems to be able to reach, but they just gravitated to this game very, very quickly. And this is actually a screenshot that I personally took. So I spent 18 months basically with these players working on my PhD, and then after I finished that project was asked by Blake to come and help basically reassemble the community and relaunch the game. And this is actually taken directly from my computer the day that Myst Online closed. But the interesting thing to me about this, as a couple of people had mentioned, is I think Blake in particular, that this community's bond was so strong that it's now lived through three different instantiations of the game and multiple recreations of it. There's also numerous things like Doom mods. And not only did players recreate Uru, they actually created completely new original ages. So one of the interesting things that is emerging now is this notion of, can you take a property with this strong of an identity and merge it with content creation? We've now seen that players understand the world really well, and they're actually pretty competent at creating some of these components of it. It's a very different model from something like Second Life, which is just a hodgepodge of everything under the sun. So is it possible to take a game like this with a very, very strong world and a very strong story and invite the players into the creative process? So with that, I'm going to end and hand it off to Ellie.
Thank you. So Ron had a picture earlier of a little picture from Mysterium. Do you know what year that was? 2002. So there was maybe, 15, 20 people in that picture. This is from Mysterium 2006, right before we'd just gotten the announcement that GameTap was picking up Uru, and there was 100 plus people in Spokane, Washington, which is not a highly traveled destination. And we invaded Cyan headquarters. But that's the sort of fan base we're talking about, is people who are willing to travel to Eastern Washington to hang out with each other and throw pizza parties for Cyan. I think since I've been involved since 2003, we've done 4 where we've thrown, the community has gotten together, raised money, and said, we're throwing Cyan a pizza party because we love them. They've gotten chocolate from all over the world, coffee. We decided they needed to be awake to program. So the community pulled together money and bought coffee and other caffeinated treats for Cyan Worlds. And I think that lasted, 3 months? It was programmers. It went fast. But that's the sort of thing the community does. That's how connected we were to Cyan, really even before Uru. We had this bond to the mythology of the world. So, what we love about the games, I have notes too, yay. I actually did some informal polling of the community. About 500 people responded, which is a little drop in the bucket, but it was still a good number. The biggest two things that came up were the gameplay, the fact that it was nonviolent, family-friendly. You could play it with your kids and not have to worry about it, not have to be screening it. And the story, the mythology, the mythos that existed already, that video Rand showed, I've seen it a dozen times, and it still gives me chills. Because it was a place that we knew. We'd heard about this world. We'd read about this world in the books. We'd had a picture in our head. And suddenly we're not only there, but we were there with other people. We could go, oh my God, that's that. So the really detailed backstory and mythology that goes with the games. The community is a little more refined, I think is the word we came up with. A little less, you don't get too many, oh my God, you noobs sort of conversation in the community. It's a little bit higher level of discourse than you might find in other MMO environments, and that was a big appeal to people. The sense of imagination and curiosity, the what's around the next corner, it was all about what are we going to find, what's going to be there, there's going to be something new. We knew Cyan was going to have something up their sleeve for us every time, and sometimes even when they didn't, we would come up with things that Cyan was going to have up their sleeves. Oh, they must mean this. And that's something that people haven't found in other games. There hasn't been that really strong sense of wonder that has drawn Uru fans into other environments. We stay because of the connections. We've become a family, sometimes an occasionally severely dysfunctional family. But we're still a family, and we still care about each other very deeply, to the point that when we lose a community member, we all feel it hard. And when we've had marriages, we've had births, we've had deaths, we all experience that as a group. A very strong belief in Cyan's vision. We get what they're doing, and we want to see it happen. An emotional investment in the mythos. We're a part of the story now. It's not just something we're reading in a book. It's not just something we're running through. We're a part of it, and we helped build it, and we helped experience it. And so it's home. Opportunities for creative expression. This is a big one. Myst fans will do linguistic work. They'll do creative projects. They'll do artwork. They'll do costuming. Any chance they have to take some skill that they have personally and apply it to the Dnei mythology and to the Myst games, they'll do it. There's been some beautiful, beautiful work done. And that willing, again, the willingness to put out personal effort. People are willing to go an extra mile to see Uru happen and to see people get together and to see communities stay together in Second Life. You know, they're willing to take that step. A desire for Uru's sake. None of us care that it hasn't gone past publishers. You know, we believe in Uru. We want Uru because Uru is worth having. No real alternative. That's a hint for you guys. And I don't say no comparable alternative, because there's lots of alternatives out there, but we, as fans, haven't found something that grabs us like Uru does. And if game developers can take the experience we've had here with Uru and go, I want that sort of experience for my players, for my fan base, for my demographic, then it's been worth it. One of the things that really came up a lot for the fan community was the URU aspect. In most MMO situations, you're not yourself. You're playing something completely different. You're role-playing, you're playing, you know, an orc, an elf, or whatever. In Uru, you were yourself. You were you. And that changed the dynamic pretty significantly. You had, you know, people who were genuinely enthused about what was happening. People developed very real, very lasting friendships. There's that sense of compassion, empathy, and connection with all the people around you. It developed into cooperative projects, cooperative efforts in and out of game, and it was a very supportive environment. But you got the icky sides too. You got people, you got the territorialism and the little group over here and the little clique over here. You've had people who have, you know, become enemies and have stayed that way on and offline. There's been, you know, accusations of elitism. Oh, you guys know more than we do. You guys must be getting fed this information. You know, what makes you so special? Because it's real people with different ideologies, and you're expressing those ideologies in a virtual environment, it clashes. You get personal attacks going back and forth. And I think partially because we are so smart, and it is that kind of higher level of discourse, it can almost get uglier than the you know, leet speak flame wars, because we're really smart and we know how to get to each other. So it can get really ugly, but when it's not, it's a really, really good batch of people. And when I say there, Uru is the people in it, not the pixels we play with. Even though we were in a virtual environment, even though we were manifesting ourselves as these little avatars, we were all very, very real. And sometimes that became a problem. Sometimes you had to balance the just a game with being a real person, and is this your online person persona talking, or is this the real you talking? Are you really mad at me, or are you doing this in game? Because that line was really blurry. Sometimes you had to explain yourself. You know, I'm yelling at you in character. Trust me, I'm not really mad at you, but I think you're a dork in character. So how to get your own best fans in the world? And that's what Rand calls us. It's the best fans in the world. Make something your people will care about. If you make something that grabs them, that says, this is important to me, they'll be there. Think outside the game console. Part of what made us so passionate about Uru is that there was so much there for us to draw on before we even got into the game. We had the books, we had the backstory, we had the linguistic guild who was figuring out the language for us. You know, we knew where we were going, we knew where we were going to end up, sort of, and there were still things, you know, you come over that rise at the volcano and you realized you knew where you were. It was an amazing experience. Treat them like partners. They're not just your paycheck. They're the people who if they become invested in your game, if they become interested in your game, are going to tell their friends and their friends and their friends. And if you work with your fans to build a foundation for your game, that foundation is going to stick around even if the game doesn't. Keep them connected to you with dynamic active community management. I think that's really, really important, especially when you've got a community that's as diverse as Uru is. Having somebody there kind of cat herding, keeping people updated on what's happening, especially, you know, in the downtime we've had since GameTap closed Uru, you know, just the, you know, what's little updates of what's going on and what the status is has meant a huge amount to the community, because we're not just sitting here twiddling our thumbs floundering. We know a little bit about what's going on. You know, we can't get all the, you know, bells and whistles, but just a little word here and there really makes a difference. Support fan efforts to stretch and explore your world. One of the very first things I did was after the original beta was shut down and they put out the first expansion pack, was to make a friend of mine and I got together. We made a fan-created demo CD that we BitTorrented and we let people download and burn and spread all over. And that was our way of saying, look, we really think this game is worth something. Please pay attention. Find ways to let your fans express that. Have fun with your community. You know, they're family. They're part of your game world. You know, get in there and hang out with them, talk with them, treat them like people, and let them treat you like people. And that's my bit.
All right, great.
As I was afraid, we're now like down to 10 minutes, and we haven't even gotten the panel discussion stuff going. If there are any questions that you have, I mean, I'll start to fire off some questions, but in the last 10 minutes, I'd rather it be pertinent to you. That's a really good question. It's a really good question. Do you want to?
Honestly, I don't know, because we never experienced it, and a lot of us hadn't ever been in another MMO. So the fact that we were seeing ourselves running around was very unique, but I don't think was necessarily a key element, because there were some glitches and there were some bugs. So occasionally you were kind of fuzzy looking, or you were white, or you know. And you looked like a ghost, and some people you had the ability to be in first person or third person. So some people stayed in first person all the time and never actually saw their own avatar.
But I think the question was the high quality of the graphics an effect in the immersion, as opposed to, you know, it was just the social networking itself that created the bonding. Is that correct?
Specifically for the avatar, I would. It added a lot. It certainly did. I would say that really the stunning landscape. Visuals. I mean, everything else that you were in involved in had that sense of wonder. And the thing you can sort of look to, too, is like Second Life or There, which has much simpler graphics. And the community is thriving there, although obviously not in the same numbers. But I think that's for a variety of reasons.
Part of the technical issues, I think, from a business standpoint, was that the client was so large, the content was so big. In a broadband delivered, even with, you know, broadband today, and RAN was designing for 1998-99, it became a real stumbling block for people to get. I mean, you look at Cub Penguin and stuff like that, Flash-based, very simple graphics, easy to get a lot of people in and connected. From a business standpoint, that did become an issue, I think.
I wanted to just say something, too. I think that worrying about the polygon count of the avatars is kind of missing the point. What's much more important is the affordances of the avatar creation that the game provided. So this idea that it was implied that you were you, I think is fundamentally important. And in my research, one of the things I found was this is the only game franchise we know of where you had a first-person experience that then became an avatar-based experience, so we can actually compare those two different things. And what I found was that when people saw themselves in the world, it gave them this sense of proprioception, which means I know where my body is in space. But more importantly, being seen by other people in the world gave people a stronger sense of presence. And this kind of flies in the face of all the traditional VR research, which says I have to be in first person to feel immersed. In fact, just the opposite is what happened. Seeing myself and seeing other people in the world made people feel more immersed. So I think that's more important. And I think in moving to other worlds, the affordance to recreate that same character, even if it was much more simple, like if you look at their very cartoon characters, it was the fact that they could sort of approximate the same appearance. So they could have just as easily gone on a Wii and made the little Wii avatars, as long as they could get it close to that same persona that they had created in Uru.
Yeah, Al. Yeah. Let me repeat the question for the tape. And the question is it's great to talk about what was successful, but what were the failures and how can we learn from them? So, Ram, why don't you take that?
I'm always going to fall back on we were ahead of our time because it's easy. I mean, that's I don't know if it's true, but it's nice to say because it makes you feel like you're brilliant or something. I think the biggest thing we did is this was an all-or-nothing proposal from an entertainment point of view. It's not like you can start up a new television network, and deliver one show every month and expect it to be successful. The guys sitting around, the original networks, sat around tables, and somebody at the front said, you know, I think that we're going to have to fill the evenings of people with new content. And somebody said, are you crazy? What are you, some kind of nut? There's no way we can do that. And we know what happens now with 600 channels, right? The point was we bit off a large task, and I'm not sure we were able to really do it. You couldn't come back every night and find something new. It was, I still think that is what the mass market wants. I think that's how people are entertained. We just couldn't quite pull that off with where we were, the money we had, the budgets.
Well, and I don't think there's any budget that would have worked, even if we had been able at Turner to be able to throw a lot of money at GameTap or at Myst Online. The content production pipeline, what was expected, was really difficult. I mean, look at Lost. Lost, I mean, ABC and TV is a mature industry right now. And Lost, at the level of quality of production that they're doing, still can't get 26 episodes out every year within time. And so it was a similar issue with Myst Online, and it's a bigger issue with, as we're looking at broadband entertainment and creating content. The fallback is Second Life, right? The fallback is reality TV. It's let's let the users create it. Let's let people make idiots of themselves and we'll all laugh about it. But at the end of the day, as an art form, we do want to see the Losts and the CSIs and the great programming happen, and that will happen. But production costs have to go down, and we have to get smarter about how we're able. The tools have to have become much better.
I think you have to give people an amount of content based on their subscription. If they're paying every month, you got to give them something substantial enough on the monthly basis that they're intrigued to not let go of that, and that's a challenge.
So I actually completely disagree. From the player's point of view, with what these guys just said, I think that there's an economic formula that didn't work clearly, but I would sort of take it from two different perspectives. One is there's nothing wrong with a niche market if you can afford to support it. And if you look at something like Meridian 59, they have a very small subscriber base, and they keep three people fully employed and paid all the time with a small but incredibly passionate audience. So that's one way to go. The other way to go is, and I think, to me, I think the biggest Really, the biggest problem with Uru is that it's such a unique game with such a unique demographic, and it happens to be a demographic that the game industry has absolutely no interest in. And I think that we have no idea how to reach a 50-year-old woman who doesn't play online games and doesn't want to fight in a game. We don't know where to find them. I would have put ads in women's magazines and in the AARP, which the Wii is selling. The Wii is going to the Association of Retired Persons Conventions and making a booth. They get it. So I think the other problem is when you have a product that's this unique and that's this original, finding the audience that's going to attach itself to it is the hardest part. You can't just advertise this on any game website. Those people won't get it. So that's, to me, the hardest thing here. I really think if more people could have been reached, this game would have actually supported the economic model that these guys are talking about.
And I will throw that in terms of GameTap. We had originally actually wanted to release Myst Online, Uru Live, as a standalone product. But that did not get approved within Turner Broadcasting. And so GameTap came to the table and said, listen, we love the game. Let's put it in as a game within GameTap. Problem is that GameTap then went after 18 to 34-year-old guys.
Completely the wrong.
And the game is clearly a baby boomer game. So I agree. And it's a really interesting market and something that everybody who's developing games should look at. I remember when we were doing focus testing on the game and Rand was there and, you know, the boys came in and the girls came in and then the teenagers and the college and the biggest resonance in any of these focus groups was, you know, middle-aged women. And it's a great market, but it's very hard to reach.
From a community perspective, too, I think that more could have been done. I mean, I think that there's an indication is the cone bowling that I talked about. There are probably a number of, for lack of a better word, cheap and easy solutions that enable people to play together that might have been explored, and some of them were. But I think that more of that could have been done to enable people, not so much to even create content, but to enjoy each other's company in a sort of, you know, with some sort of pastime, and while they're waiting for the next installment next month.
Mm-hmm. Other question? Yes.
I'll try to sort of synopsize the question, but you're working for the AARP, you said, or marketing to them? Okay. Right. So the question was really about how could we reach that audience and what sort of game design features would you want to reach that audience. So actually, as a follow-up study to this, I actually did a study of baby boomer gamers. And actually, 300 is statistically significant, so your 500 is fine. And I found a couple things that were quite interesting. One was that 99% of the 300 people in my survey played exclusively or almost exclusively on a PC. So this notion that the PC market is dead, that's where you want to look for your baby boomer player. We also found a generation skip where grandparents were playing with their grandchildren, but the parents were not. So you'd have this kind of, and especially in terms of sort of the nonviolent thing and less adult kinds of oriented play, this idea of the more civilized player. I did a lot of research there's a bunch of community sites like Boomer Gamer and the older gamers. And the common thing you hear in this is that younger gamers in the demographic that is targeted by most game companies are basically very rude in social situations, and older players don't like that. They don't want to hear a lot of cursing. They don't want to be harassed. They want to just have help if they need help. If they're new, they don't want to be treated like a second-class citizen. They actually want people to help, and they like to help people. Helping newbies was their second favorite activity in the survey that I did. Exploring was their first. So exploration is actually a really great game mechanic for the baby boomer. Also, most of them hated any kind of console input device, so this whole thumb twitch thing, and also speed. Games that had time limits and speed were typically not preferred. Racing games were the least favorite games on the list of genres. So I think we just need to rethink what, you know, there's this kind of almost biblical idea of what gamers want, but that's a very narrow demographic that pretty much ignores everybody outside of that little bubble, which is really just a niche market, if you think about it. And I think also as players get older, their tastes change. So you get people that maybe were playing Pong in college, had kids, and now they want to play again, but they want something more intellectually stimulating, perhaps. So those are a few. And I think the challenge, the puzzle, the intellectual stimulation of Uru and Myst is one of the big hooks for this demographic. They want to think.
One more question, then we've got to wrap this up. Yes, sir.
What did we do to keep the fire going?
You got to make it short
and sweet.
Come
okay.
up and we'll answer afterwards. Repeat the question.
The question is kind of what besides just getting the game up and running did we do to keep it alive? Until Uru itself, in that period in between the two official Uru Lives, there was a strong sandbox element. The people running the shards, it was individually run instances of the game, had developed tools that could let administrators do fun things and let players do fun things. There's an in-game control called the Kai, the key. Kind of depends on which side of the coast you're on, what you call it. And what they developed was little slash commands, little slash jump would jump you up in the air. And if you jumped up in the air in certain areas, you would pass, through the bottom of a collision plane and then land on top of it, and you could run around on top of it. And we would use that for playing games like Sardines, where we'd get 40, 50 people in the city, and one person would hide, and we'd have to find them and all squish into this one little space. We had way too much fun with the cones. We figured out how to, make them huge. So you'd have 50-foot cones sliding around the city. And that's the sort of thing we did to keep us entertained, on top of using those tools to explore areas of the city that Cyan hadn't given us access to, but you could fly up and you could hover and you could see, here's this building that you can't see at all from the area that was released in the game, but it's fully textured and there's a staircase and there's stuff inside, and what the heck was that going to be, and when were we going to get to see it, and we would sit and discuss this sort of thing. What did this mean? What was this going to be? And that's the sort of thing we found to do. Radio shows, gatherings, the Denny Olympics. Yes, that was we developed a group of people developed an Olympic Games.
I want to add just real quick to that, because I think we're done. Yeah, so I just want to mention that one of the terms that emerged from my thesis is what I call productive play. And I actually have a paper about it if anyone's interested I can point you to. But basically when players go from playing to producing and what that transition is, and a lot of what Ellery is talking about is this idea of players sort of taking the initiative to make their own events and invent their own games. Hide and Seek was another game that was very popular in the world. And it's a game you can't play in there or Second Life because they have persistent avatar names over your head. So it was very unique to the Uru environment to have that affordance. Objects that can be moved around. Anything that doesn't stick to the ground is emergent gameplay in the making. It's the only MMOG I've ever seen that has objects that aren't glued to the ground. They put a soccer ball in one of the newer ages that they built under GameTap and put two poles, and people figured out, oh, they made us a soccer field. And they started playing with that. So I think you have to, what I would say is a really smart thing to do is leave some space for your players. Let them make up their own games and their own gameplay and their own economies or whatever. Don't feel like you have to pack it all in with information. Most of what people enjoy about Myst is the process of what in the heck is going on? What does this hieroglyph mean? What's behind that door, etc.?
I want to thank you all very, very much. Thank you, and good day.